Is that on, Brad? Okay. Good morning. Oz Guinness, a Christian thinker with whom most of you will be familiar, has said of our culture in the strange age in which we live, quote, "Everybody is talking and no one is listening. The rarest and most precious commodity in the modern world is focused attention," end quote. Let me repeat that. Quote, "Everybody is talking and no one is listening. The rarest and most precious commodity in the modern world is focused attention," end quote. The reason I think that this thought resonates so deeply within us is because we all know, frankly, that it's true, and it enjoins us to deep, sober introspection. More than that, we know it bespeaks a problem of our own creation, one that we are often reticent to deal with head on. That problem, collective sin, cultural failing, whatever it is, if we had to name it, boils down to an unwillingness on our part to fulfill Christ's second great commandment, to love our neighbor as ourselves. And of course, Christ's second great commandment is inextricably bound up with the first, to love God with our whole being. For as we've talked about many times at this church, how can we fulfill one command and not fulfill the other? And the answer is we cannot. So this morning, I want to examine how we love our neighbors as ourselves and by extension love God by giving those made in the Lord's image our focused attention, as Dr. Guinness puts it. Specifically, I want to look at how we do this in our conversations with others and why I think we need to work on this in the first place. And the train of thought here is hopefully not too hard to follow. One, we are commanded by Jesus to love others, not controversial. Two, loving others entails building genuine, God-honoring relationships with them. And then thirdly, the primary way we do that, the primary way we build genuine, God-honoring relationships is through conversations, and ideally many conversations over many years. And thus, I want to give a lecture this morning about the need for Christians to have good conversations, and that's a bit ironic to be delivering a lecture on that topic. So far, so good. But have you stopped and have we stopped to consider how we, as Westerners, do at this seemingly simple, mundane, pedestrian, everyday task of just conversing with other people? If you had to sum up the state of our cultural ability to speak properly, constructively, lovingly with one another, how would you do that? How would you describe our conversations in general if you only had one word to do it? I can tell you a few words that come to my mind, at least the ones that are fit to say on a Sunday morning. That would be inadequate, oblivious, tangential, inconsequential, contrived. In certain instances, I might describe our collective cultural conversation as wicked or sinful. But is it really fair to describe our day-to-day chit-chat with friends, family, work associates, and so forth with such strong words? Can we really apply such language to our flippant discussions with Bob about the weather? I think we can sometimes, so let me make the case. And to be clear here, I'm not saying that we suffer from this conversational ineptitude or depravity as much here at church, although I would say we are not free from the concern. Most folks here are easy to talk to, have good things to say, and care for one another. But again, we have work to do. Still, if you take stock of how most people speak with one another in our society on the whole, the situation is just not good. Far from being a people who can speak caringly, winsomely, and intelligently to one another, we act more like a bunch of caterwauling felines on the fence. Discourse, dialogue, and debate are quite obviously not our strong suits. For instance, at work, I sit at lunch with coworkers. I do this most days, and Chad and Lon both work where I work, and you can all probably identify with such experiences. But I sit and I listen to them talk ad nauseum about themselves, often without taking a breath for several minutes. And there's no conversational continuity or trajectory. There's no deference to other people at the table. There's very little content. And most of the time, there's zero awareness that other people are even at the table to begin with. One will speak about something funny her child did. The next will take that as his cue to talk about something funny his child did. The next will mention how drunk she got the previous evening. The last will chime in about fantasy football or something like that. No empathy, no social intelligence, no interest in the affairs of others. And I think we're in danger of seeing this as such a regular occurrence that it doesn't strike us as perverse and stupid. What do you call such a disparate collection of emoting and storytelling, devoid of segues and rife with foolishness? We call it conversation today, but that doesn't warrant the name, not even close. This is not an uncommon thing. You can all, as I mentioned before, think of similar conversations that you've been a part of recently or have experienced or have sat on the sidelines of and wondered what is going on here. Strings of unrelated speeches made to nobody and prompted by nothing. An uninterested group of people who just happen to be in close proximity to each other and happen to mutter nonsense while taking a momentary break from looking at their phones. I think we can all identify with that. I was recently at a coffee shop reading a book for a couple hours, and there were two young people sitting behind me who were talking, and I honestly could not tell you what it was about. They were loud enough that I had to overhear what they were saying without moving. And as I listened to them talk, again, for 2 hours, if I had to summarize the content of what they were saying, I wouldn't be able to, and I would liken it more to a couple of newborns babbling incoherently at each other. And the newborns would have accomplished more because that is their function and that is what they are supposed to do. And these 20-somethings, that's not what they're supposed to be doing, needless to say. To say that there were two ships passing in the night would be uncharitable to ships, and we all want to be charitable to ships. A better analogy would be the sinking of the Titanic, but only if it had been rent asunder by a torpedo and struck by a meteorite and boarded by the Uruk-hai at the same time it was gashed by an iceberg. Wendell told me recently about a pastor's luncheon, that he attended, at which he sat at a table full of pastors to eat lunch, as you tend to do at luncheons. And he tried in vain to engender constructive, good conversation with other pastors, men who are specifically trained and whose job it is to build meaningful relationships with their congregants through conversation. And over that lunch, nobody asked him any questions. He would say things like, tell me about your church, or where are you from, or what are you preaching on recently, or what are you reading? They took their turns to answer those questions and in turn showed him no interest, showed one another no interest, and went on pontificating about themselves. They could not be bothered to reciprocate. Perhaps Wendell caught them on a bad day. Perhaps I caught my coworkers on a bad day every day. Perhaps you all catch people, you know, not at their best. We need to be charitable, but when it happens all the time, every day across many years, then it becomes less of a coincidence or, hey, maybe we should be charitable about this and more like, hey, there's a problem here. We need to address it. What is likely in the case of Wendell is that these pastors just stink at loving people in that particular way, and they need to work on it just as we need to work on it. How about our interactions with other people, taking the focus off of others and their conversational failings? What about our own? How are our interactions with other believers on Sunday mornings, on Wednesdays, on throughout the week? How about unbelievers? Have you ever sat down and just thought exactly through how you treat others in conversation? Or have you taken stock on a regular basis of, man, how am I doing in that area? Seems like there's some stuff to work on. Now, I realize that when I say that, it's easy for me to say that as an extrovert, right? Everyone is wired differently. I get that. We have all sort of, if there was ever a church that delights in personality inventories, it would be our church. whether you've taken the Myers-Briggs or some weird free facsimile of it online, whether you've talked with Tom and Drew about the four scenarios and happen to be averse to the dinner party, or if you've read through the love languages and find that you're something other than words of affirmation, I understand not everybody is wired the same. But there is a point at which we need to demand the same level of behavior from all of us, because the scriptures do, quite frankly. Our primary means of communication, regardless of our personality and temperament, is through conversation, verbal conversation primarily, although that's being supplanted more and more by written conversation in emails, texts, and so forth. We all need to take stock of how we're doing in this area, regardless of our temperament, once again. Here are some simple but hopefully not easy questions to ask yourself regarding your interaction with your neighbors. Number one, do I approach my time with others as a means to get what I want and have my needs serviced, or do I look for ways to serve them first? What is the primary motivation for going into each conversation? Number two, do I simply wait my turn to tell stories I want to divulge or have been on my mind? Or do I take a genuine interest in all that my conversation partner has to offer? Number three, do I block out distractions to give my undivided attention to those with whom I am speaking? Or do I let my mind wander to other things? Perhaps one of my favorite quotes from the missionary Jim Elliot is, he says, "Wherever you are, be all there." And we are just not very good at that. Wherever you are, be all there. Block out distractions. Give your undivided, as Dr. Guinness says, focused attention. Number four, do I take my conversation seriously, knowing I could be shaping the eternal destiny of those with whom I am speaking? Or do I fail to appreciate the gravity of the person or people before me? We all fall into this. I fail at this often, treating our conversations in a very mundane or pedestrian way. But the reality is, as C.S. Lewis says, you know, every interaction, every conversation, every email, every text, every communication we have with other people is shepherding them in one of two directions. And so we need to be mindful of that. Number five, and lastly here, do I direct the conversations towards significant or meaningful subjects? Or do I allow my time with people to be spent always talking about inconsequential things or the latest bits of trivia that have come across my news feed? Do I talk about celebrities, sports, weather, those sort of things? Again, those topics are not in and of themselves bad topics, but when that's all you talk about with people and that's how your relationship is substantiated based on your fantasy football team or which store you shop at, that is not a real relationship, quite obviously. How we answer questions like these will determine how much work we have to do, and I know I have a lot to do. Though the scriptures don't explicitly spell it out, it's hard to develop a theology of conversation, or a philosophy of conversation, rather. I think there are some clues in the scriptures about how the Lord views our conversation and how he would have us have them. One of the first principles is that other people made in the image of the living God are to be pursued for their own sake. This is a point that even secular philosophers like John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham understand, that as the highest form of creation, we are each to be pursued for our own sake, not as a means to an end. And we know that intellectually, I think, but in practice, in conversation, if we could... And isn't this one of the most painful things to do is listen to yourself talk, listen to recordings of yourself talking? It is a wildly painful experience. But if we did that, if we could do that, I think we would all be surprised at how much we turn everything back on ourselves and have ulterior motives in conversations. What can I get out of this? Or how can I get what I want and then leave and not make sure the other person's needs are addressed. Men and women made in the image of God are not means to an end, and they are not merely sounding boards against which we cast our smattering of disorganized thoughts, just as God is not in prayer. Other people are to be approached with a great seriousness and joy, knowing that God has afforded us limited time with them to interact. It is God's good favor that has allowed us to speak freely into one another's lives, and we should give those opportunities the respect they deserve, because, again, our time is fleeting together. Further, another point that I think the scriptures make pretty well, conversation is not designed for one party's vanity. It's very easy to fall into, and to the detriment of all other parties involved. And just thinking about the act of speaking in the scriptures, of course, Genesis 1 starts with God speaking the creation into existence. Now, this is a word picture, but God is imparting life and breath and organization to creation as a good and perfect gift. The heavens and the earth, as we read about this morning, are born out of nothing. The wonder of creating springs from the Lord as a holy human-centered activity. This is a holy other-centered activity, as we talk about often here, that there is no benefit to God in creating us. It is all for our benefit, and that is remarkable. God speaks creation. He speaks us into existence. He imparts life and breath to the material universe entirely for our benefit. In John 1:1, Christ is described as the pre-incarnate Word, or Logos, who was sent to mankind as a benevolent emissary, an embodiment of God's goodwill to men. Throughout the Bible, speech has a markedly other-centered focus. Another point, conversing with those made in the image of God is a privilege and not a burden. Now, I understand for those who are a little more introverted, it can sap your energy more than it can an extrovert, but still, the fact remains, it is a privilege to speak with people made in the image of the living God, because it is reflective of His character and His glory and His goodness and His wonder. Yes, it may not be equally enjoyable to fellowship with each individual person. We'll naturally gravitate to some and not necessarily so to others. However, the Bible's view of each man and woman is that he or she is uniquely valuable, having something particular to offer His kingdom that others may not. How can we not find great joy and fascination in delving into all of what each person brings to this world? How can you not find great joy and wonder in talking with Julian Nelson about anything? How can we not? Out of everything else that we behold on this earth, humans are the most amazing and magical creatures we will probably ever encounter. And this is Chesterton through and through. The key to unlocking the treasure within each person is observation and conversation. Jane Austen writes in Pride and Prejudice, "What are men compared to rocks and mountains?" Well, it seems clear from the scriptures that God views, and we also ought to view, a single, seemingly dull, maybe obtuse human as infinitely more valuable than the most majestic mountains, most gorgeous sunset, or anything else that nature has to offer. It would not be hyperbolic to say that we ought to just sometimes stand in wonder and amazement at one another when we approach each other, stupefied by the value, mystery, and grandeur before us, for it reflects, however dimly, that of God. Further, if you look at how Jesus interacted with Jews and Gentiles alike in the New Testament, He treated each conversation differently. It's remarkable to note that the Son of God, who had every right to draw every conversation inexorably back to Himself and focusing on Himself, instead loved His interlocutors, those with whom He was speaking, enough to tailor His words and each conversation to their specific needs. We ought to remind ourselves of that the next time we spend 15 minutes of someone's time going on and on about ourselves and completely ignoring their needs. Jesus repeatedly made His interactions with sinful humans about them rather than Himself. Finally, as Christians, our duty is to truth, for God is truth. How can we follow through on the Great Commission, biblical commandments, and all other directives that God has given us, unless we spend our time convening with others regarding the truth? This requires deep, concerted, loving conversation, and it necessitates an attentive ear on our part. We all fall short of treating one another as we ought to in dialogue. That's obvious. I'm not here to beat us up over that. But here are some simple things we can do to start to change for the better in this case. first thing is learn to ask good questions and be actually interested in the responses to those questions. You will do more for the kingdom of God by practicing this skill than perhaps any other interpersonal ability, learning to ask good questions. Why? Because you can probably count on one hand the number of good, thoughtful questions you yourself were asked within the last few weeks. Think about it. When was the last time, apart from maybe a few select relationships you have, when was the last time you had a genuinely good, thoughtful question asked of you by someone who is not in the habit of doing that? The answer may be months, it may be years, I don't know. Truthfully, many people can go that long. They can go months, they can go years, especially unbelievers who may not have fellowship with anyone who really cares about them, without having somebody display this kind of focused attention towards him or her. And this is a travesty. Can you imagine trying to understand the love of God when you have not been asked a good question, a loving, caring, deeply thought out question in months and months and months and months or years and years and years? I cannot fathom understanding God properly if that were the case in my life. People love talking about themselves. Questions give them the chance to do that. You can dictate the content and focus of a conversation if you're the only person around who is willing to show this kind of interest in other people. As we mentioned before, there is little cohesion in dialogue these days, and we each have the power to fix that by taking the initiative. In fact, it requires very little effort to take a conversation that you're a part of and bring it back to some semblance of coherence because the standards are so low. Plus, once others know that you tend to ask good questions, they will seek out time with you, often secretly hoping that you'll afford them another chance to open up. If you set a good example for how truly rich conversations can be, people will be drawn into it. They will be, for they know deep down that there's something lacking in the current state of affairs. And we should insist on not allowing our time with others to revolve around ourselves. Certainly, we should be willing to talk about ourselves. After all, we are to love others as we love ourselves, which does imply self-love. And if nobody talked about themselves, we would probably just sit in silence. But there is something wrong if we can obliviously and insufferably go on and on about ourselves for 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes without an alarm going off in our head that screams, like, warning, you need to shut it. You need to shut it down. There's another person here. You need to ask some questions. The second thing is for us to work on our ability to actively listen. And we have a number of folks here that do this remarkably well, even people who aren't paid to do it well, like Tom and Drew. So an attentive ear is even rarer and more valuable than an inquisitive mouth, I think. If we as listeners cannot muster the interest to genuinely pay attention to our dialogue partners, the fault is with us and not with them. In other words, if we are dismissive because others are boring to talk to or uninteresting or what have you, we've found the source and the core of the problem, and that's us. That's not them. Christians should be enamored with God's creation, and the height of that creation is our fellow man. It takes a great lack of imagination and a seared soul not to have any interest in plumbing the depths of those with whom we converse and fellowship. There are magnificent creatures with great wisdom, truth, love, experiences to impart to us at our very disposal, in our very midst, if only we would listen. In fact, you may say that it is a secretly selfish endeavor to actively listen. For much like an interrogator with the CIA, you ought to pry as much valuable information as you can from your conversation partner in the short time you have together. Actively listening is also a mutually soul-building enterprise, for it allows the needs of multiple parties to be met at the same time. It also allows for effective evangelism, because who would ever want to hear about the self-sacrificial good news of Jesus' redemption of mankind from a person who is only enamored with him or herself? If you cannot sacrifice a few seconds in conversation for somebody else, what appeal is the good news of Jesus going to have? I don't think any. Thirdly, is that we can do much better in minimizing distractions in our conversations. And it probably will not be hard to envision where I'm going with this point. This means getting off of our freaking phones. If there is a site or situation that serves to define our times, it is a group of people seemingly associated with one another by geography or physical proximity, all on their phones, not paying attention to one another. To borrow a phrase from our recently departed President Obama, let me be clear, this will not work. While we must say that there is nothing intrinsically wrong about using a cell phone, tablet, laptop, whatever, when they are prioritized over men and women made in the image of God in one's vicinity, then there's a big problem. Even if you happen to be texting, emailing, Snapchatting, Facebooking, whatever it is, whatever the social media du jour is, even if you happen to be doing that with other people at the time, you're still prioritizing a less genuine and frankly, fake form of communication for another. Would you rather eat imitation crab meat from Kroger or Alaskan King crab legs right off the boat? Would you rather behold the Eiffel Tower in Paris, France? Or would you rather buy a 1/200th size replica of it in the gift shop across the street? Similarly, when we consistently choose a text or an email or a Snapchat or whatever it is over a flesh and blood person sitting in front of us, we foolishly choose a facsimile over somebody, something with real value. As far as you can, demand that your time with others not allow technology to get in its way. Refuse to bring your phone into a restaurant on a date. Politely ask the barista at the coffee shop to turn the music down a peg so you can actually hear one another speak. Stay away from venues with televisions covering every wall, unless, of course, you're going there to watch television. Don't fire up your computer or tablet immediately when you get home from work. Again, I say these things as much to myself as I do to you. I'm particularly bad about that last detail. What we will find as we remove technology as a surrogate for healthy conversation is that our love for others will deepen and our thinking will clarify and our focus will start to change. Is it any wonder that groups of people sit around together, all individually talking about themselves, never really connecting with one another, as my coworkers do, when they practice this skill for hours each day on social media? It is no surprise. What passes for conversation these days is often nothing more than a collection of verbalized Twitter or Facebook posts. Perhaps the social media other modes of social media are other people centered in theory, but they don't really work out that way in practice. At least that's what I've found. In practice, posting on Facebook or Twitter or whatever often drives the focus back to my needs, my thoughts, my emotions, my situation. We may fool ourselves into thinking that we're really concerned for others as we vicariously and voyeuristically scroll through hundreds of posts at a time from our acquaintances or friends, but the research on social media use bears out time and time again that this activity has the opposite effect. It makes us more self-centered, more narrow, and more unhappy with our current state and ourselves. Again, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with medium or with social media in general, but we are allowing it to actively compromise our what should be wonderful and genuine conversations with others. This bringing the attention and focus back on ourselves is a practice in dematuration. What I mean here is that we take it as a sign of maturation and sanctification as a child learns over the years that he or she is not the focal point of the universe. As young people grow up, it's a good and profitable thing to see them come to the cognition of the fact that other people really exist and that they have real needs and that those needs matter. We call folks who fail to inculcate this attitude of other-centeredness as they grow narcissists and sociopaths. The issue, of course, is that we all know grown adults who have allowed their focus in life to go from an ever-expanding one to a re-narrowing, to the point where there's no room for anyone except themselves. Let this not be said of us. Let us rightly love ourselves as we are commanded to, yes, but to more and more make it a priority, as Paul mentions to us in Philippians 2, to consider the needs of others and to consider others better than ourselves. If you need examples of people to emulate who do a remarkable job of considering the needs of others, Your homework might be to include talking with, I don't know, everyone here, most people here, because there are so many who are fantastic at it, including but not limited to the Brains, the Detmers, the Stevens, the Nelsons, the St. Peters, the other Nelsons, the Millers, the Powers, the Birches, the Warrens, basically everyone here. And you can use the time after the service to really do that. I mean, in my mind, some of the richest, oftentimes the richest and most fruitful and excellent conversations I have on a weekly or monthly basis happen here after the service. And I don't think that's an accident. So to wrap up, there's really no magic formula to loving others in conversations. Most of the things we need to work on are core biblical values, common courtesy, common sense, although those things aren't all that common anymore. They are hard to implement, but again, they shouldn't be hard to understand. There's very little focused attention, as Dr. Guinness has said, to go around in a world that's starving for it. I mean, frankly, it is starving for it. So it's our job to fix that. It's our job to work hard to fix that amongst ourselves, amongst unbelievers in our conversations with family, friends, work associates, so forth. I think we'll find that our love and appreciation for God and for others will definitely and should grow as we practice that discipline.
Knowing that I would come up and say a few words after Nate, I kept thinking, what could I add to what what is he missing? Is there something I could punctuate a little bit better? I can't think of anything that needs to be added to that. That was just very well done. Nate, where are you at? Did you leave? There you are, right there. I'm so used to you slipping out. You had several categories with bullet points under each one. Can you draft those up, send them to me so I can mail them out to everybody? Would everybody appreciate that? Absolutely. Those are just great suggestions. So thank you, Nate, for that. Actually, we are working through this in the youth group. Just started this last Wednesday night. We'll continue again this Wednesday night. I've even given the kids some of the assignments along this line. I told them to pay attention to Nate, knowing that he'd be talking about this. So I'll be putting youth group kids on the spot because we had a lot of good material this morning for that. But obviously, this doesn't apply just to youth group kids. This is a skill that we all need to develop and really really put into practice and take it seriously. The whole skills of asking questions and listening intently and respecting the other person through this art of making relationships through how we talk. And scriptures are clear. We are to let our conversations be full of grace seasoned with salt. And that's not just, you know, filler. That's in there for a purpose to really challenge and exhort us. So why don't we stand? And no, wait, I'm sorry. We have Jessica. Yes, I'm sorry. Jessica's going to come and got ahead of myself. No. We want to hear some thoughts about our closing song.
All right. Today's hymn is Jesus Paid It All. And I think it's some one that we likely all know and could probably sing just from memory. This is a simple hymn in terms of it being very straightforward. There's not difficult phrases. There's not unusual vocabulary. However, let's not mistake the familiar and the easy to understand as boring or mundane. It's clear in verses 1 and 3, we are reminded that we are weak, that we bring nothing good to deserve or to claim God's grace. It is Christ who suffered agony and humiliation instead of me. And for this, I ought to be struck by profound gratitude every moment of every day. I ought to be bubbling over with this great news and freedom and hope to all my acquaintances and in all my conversations. My life should look markedly different. Knowing that Christ covered the steep cost of my sin with his blood. And I confess I fail at this daily. So I, as I have been reflecting on this hymn, have become very convicted of this and want to be intentional about changing that. So please join me in singing gratefully that Jesus paid it all, but also consider how this gift should affect our daily lives and interaction with others.